This week, global finance is really fixated on just one number, a single data point that carries this almost disproportionate weight. That number is 89.6%.
Exactly. And that's the probability of a huge Fed move that could unlock, well, everything.
We're tracking a confluence of events here.
Yeah, we are. The economic calendar, the specific tokens that are signaling a shift, and these massive tech upgrades that could turn what feels like a wild prediction into reality.
We're really diving into the macro forces that are driving this next risk-on cycle.
Yep, let's do it.
Welcome to the Deep Dive. Our mission today is to move beyond the headlines and really unpack a dense stack of sources covering what is, I mean, a truly pivotal week.
We're synthesizing everything, the big macro signals, the technicals on Bitcoin, and some of the most critical regulatory and engineering breakthroughs coming out of the crypto space.
We're going to look hard at why Wednesday is so important for macro watchers.
It's not just another news day. It's really a day of inflection for monetary policy and how that one decision or, non-decision is going to fuel or deflate expectations for 2026.
And we'll also look at some corporate earnings, specifically tracking this convergence of AI services and energy providers. That connection, I think, tells a much deeper story about where institutional capital is starting to move.
And finally, we're going to spend some significant time on the two foundational regulatory pillars and the technical speed boosts that are, well, they're essential. They're prerequisites for broad institutional adoption in the next cycle.
We'll guide you through the data, making sure you walk away with a clear understanding of the what and, more importantly, the why.
For sure. Especially concerning Bitcoin's current structural support and this rumored 500,000 transactions per second speed boost coming to one of the major networks. Okay, let's unpack this.
So the narrative this week is all about liquidity injection and why this specific macro calendar is so front-loaded with potential catalysts.
Yeah. You know, since the dust settled on the 2020 shutdown, we really haven't seen a week where so many high-stakes indicators have all converged like this, especially right before the year end.
It feels like the whole market is preparing for some kind of policy confirmation.
That's a perfect way to put it. The sources lay out this stack of critical data points that all feed into the Fed's narrative, and it really does feel like the entire economy is just holding its breath.
So let's set the stage. We can start with the setup from earlier in the week, the September JOLTS job openings data.
Mm-hmm.
And just for context, JOLTS is a measure of the number of actual job openings available in the U.S. economy.
Right. And its significance goes way beyond just a simple job tally. I mean, JOLTS gives you the clearest snapshot of the demand for labor versus the supply.
So when you have more openings than people looking for work, it suggests a tight labor market.
Exactly. And a tight labor market, historically, translates directly into upward wage pressure.
Which is a key component of that sticky, services-led inflation that the Fed has been struggling to tame.
For sure. So if JOLTS comes in hotter than expected, it signals the economy is still running hot. And that could potentially delay the Fed's pivot towards, easing policy.
But on the other hand, if we see a noticeable cooling, fewer openings,
then it suggests the Fed's previous rate hikes are finally filtering through, that it's slowing the job market down, and that cooling gives them the crucial cover they need to adopt a more dovish stance.
It lets them signal that inflation is under control.
Right. And the focus can shift towards avoiding an overly restrictive policy. It's really the foundational context that's going to shape expectations for the first quarter.
And all of this, of course, points us straight to Wednesday. The entire global financial narrative this week just hinges on the December Fed interest rate decision.
It's the gravitational center of everything. And that data point you opened with, that 89.6% probability of a rate cut, I mean, that's coming from the CME group, and it just shows how overwhelmingly the market has priced this outcome in.
That near 90% certainty is, it's just astonishing in a world that's defined by uncertainty.
It is. It means expectations aren't just priced in. They are completely baked into every single asset model globally. And the implication is profound.
Right, because rate cuts lower the cost of capital. They're universally seen as positive for risk assets.
Yeah, when the cost of money drops, two things happen at once. First, fixed income, the safe money, it becomes less attractive.
So it pushes institutional capital to go chase yield somewhere else.
Exactly. And second, the discount rate that you apply to future growth earnings falls. This makes high growth, high potential assets like tech and crypto immediately more valuable in today's terms. It's the mechanical link between a Fed cut and, number go up.
But the flip side of that 89.6% certainty is the catastrophic risk of a shock.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if the Fed, despite everything, decides to hold steady, If that tiny 10.4% chance actually happens, it would instantly trigger a massive repricing.
It would signal that the Fed sees an inflation risk that the market has completely missed.
And that would lead to a sharp, aggressive, risk-off contraction. The higher the certainty, the more volatile the surprise.
Mm. And here's the crucial nuance here. The actual decision, the rate move itself, that's only half the story.
Mm-hmm.
The other, and you could argue more important piece of Wednesday's puzzle, is Fed Chair Powell's press conference and his forward guidance.
Yeah, think of it this way. The rate cut is the direction of travel. The press conference is the speed limit and the destination.
So it tells us if this is just a one-off adjustment or the first step in a sustained multi-cut cycle.
Right. Investors are going to be scrutinizing his language for any hint of a dovish tilt. Is he confident? Does he suggest policy will continue to ease? If he sounds cautious, it dampens enthusiasm. If he sounds open to more cuts, well, the liquidity fire just accelerates.
The market's hunting for clues about the pace of easing. That's the real long-term driver.
And that leads us to the most powerful potential catalyst of all. These swirling rumors that the Fed might also signal a shift toward balance sheet expansion.
Okay, so we need to spend some time here because this is often misunderstood.
It really is. It's high-level finance policy.
Let's break down what balance sheet expansion means and why it's so much more potent than just a rate cut. We're not just talking about lowering the cost of borrowing.
No, not at all. We're talking about the active injection of fresh capital into the system. It's the kind of tool the Fed only deploys when they feel the need to provide deep structural support or, you know, stimulation.
So when the Fed does this, often called quantitative easing or QE, they actively go out and purchase long-term government debt, usually treasury bonds.
And they buy them from commercial banks on the open market.
Yeah.
But here's the thing. They don't use existing funds. They essentially create new reserves out of thin air to make these purchases.
That creation of new reserves is the critical part.
It is. The banks sell their bonds to the Fed, and suddenly their liquid reserves just swell up. It dramatically increases their capacity and their incentive to lend because they have this massive new pool of reserves just sitting there.
And this has a cascading effect, right?
Totally. By buying up these long-term bonds, the Fed drives up the price, which pushes down their yield, the long-term interest rates. It's a deliberate effort to force capital out of those safe long-term assets and into riskier ventures where growth can be found. It is, quite literally, the active pumping of liquidity.
And historically, when the Fed pairs a rate cut with balance sheet expansion,
investors recognize the signal instantly. The calculus shifts from capital preservation to chasing yield. It's a universal flip into risk-on mode.
Money flows out of fixed income and directly into growth equities and, most aggressively, into the crypto market.
It's the engine firing on all cylinders.
Mm-hmm.
So if Powell confirms a cut and even hints at QE, that's the maximum possible structural tailwind for risk assets. You just can't get a better setup.
And then to round out the week, we have Thursday's indicators. We've got the weekly snapshot of unemployment filings with initial jobless claims.
Yeah, and a steadier rising number there just reinforces the narrative that the labor market is loosening, which gives the Fed more flexibility to stay dovish.
And then the other key item on Thursday is something you really want to watch, the U.S. 30-year bond auction.
This is a direct gauge of institutional confidence. When the Treasury auctions off long-term debt, we're watching the demand.
Strong demand suggests that the big global buyers' pension funds, sovereign wealth funds, still have deep confidence in the long-term stability of U.S. debt.
Right. They're betting on safety. But if that auction sees weak demand, or if the yields required by buyers are unexpectedly high, that's a red flag.
It signals that institutions might be pulling their money out of the long-term safety trade and positioning it elsewhere.
Yep. It's an immediate barometer of that macro rotation. It tells us whether institutional preference is for safety or for growth.
So given that near 90% odds of a cut are baked in, what happens to risk assets if Powell shocks everyone and decides to hold steady on rates?
A no-move shock would cause an immediate, sharp, and frankly, painful risk-off market contraction globally.
Okay, so shifting from the vast macro environment to the micro indicators,
mm-hmm.
corporate earnings.
Yeah, these are critical this week because they reflect how specific companies are actually navigating this high-rate environment. It's a real-time health check on the economy.
We're looking for evidence of resilience, margin pressure, and forward momentum in those cutting-edge sectors.
For sure. And like the sources point out, sectors like AI and energy are generally excellent frontrunners. They signal broader market shifts before they hit the general economy. They tell us where the next wave of growth capital is going.
So let's start with a litmus test of sentiment, what the sources call animal spirits. The stock highlighted here is GameStop, GME.
GME is so fascinating. Its earnings are less about fundamental valuation and way more about the psychological state of the retail trader. It became the symbol of high-risk speculation during the last cycle.
So when GME shows surprising strength, it acts as a barometer for retail enthusiasm.
Exactly. When animal spirits, that old Keynesian term for the spontaneous urge to action, are running high, retail traders are comfortable pouring money into high-risk speculation. A surprisingly positive GME report suggests overall market confidence is far higher than the cautious institutional narrative might suggest.
It's a signal of pure speculative heat returning to the market.
It is. And that sets the stage for the true forward-looking plays, what the sources call the AI and energy nexus. We've got key earnings releases from Oracle, Cognite, and UEC.
Oracle is the cloud infrastructure behemoth, so it's a strong proxy for enterprise IT spending.
Right. And Cognite, though it's smaller, is an AI services company. They sell the actual applications powered by AI. And then you have UEC.
Uranium Energy Corporation. This is the strategic connection we need to focus on.
Yeah, the sources are hinting at the potential winners of the AI energy race. And you have to understand the existential constraint facing the AI boom right now. Power. The scaling of AI requires an exponential increase in power consumption.
The numbers are just staggering. Training and running these large language models demands constant, reliable, massive electricity supplies. Data centers are becoming the single largest consumers of power on local grids.
So when AI services companies like Cognite report earnings, we're looking at their ability to scale. But that scaling relies entirely on the infrastructure from Oracle, the cloud, and crucially, the power availability from companies like UEC.
And UEC, dealing in uranium, implies the specific energy source being watched is nuclear.
Exactly. Low carbon, high density, always on power. For AI data centers that cannot afford downtime, nuclear is increasingly seen as the ultimate reliable energy backbone.
So tracking these specific earnings is strategic.
It is. Cognite shows us the demand for AI. Oracle shows us the infrastructure being deployed. And UEC shows us the investment flow into the foundational power source required to keep the lights on and the chips running.
And if UEC and Cognite are both showing strength,
it validates the narrative that the constraints are being solved through massive infrastructure investment. It suggests the biggest returns might not be in the software layer alone, but in the companies that underpin the physical reality of the AI world.
They're two sides of the same rapidly accelerating engine.
For sure. Strong earnings here indicate a rapidly intensifying infrastructure arms race, and it justifies the move of capital into these front-running sectors.
So do AI and energy earnings offer better foresight than traditional sector reports right now?
Yes, because these sectors often front-run upcoming significant market shifts in infrastructure and computational demand.
Now we can transition from the macro tailwinds to the primary recipient of this risk-on liquidity, Bitcoin. It's sitting in a structurally fascinating position right now.
It really is.
Yeah.
Bitcoin is exhibiting the classic characteristics of a compressed coiled spring. The technical sources confirm it continues to respect its long-term ascending trend line. And this isn't some fleeting signal. It's a sustained structural floor.
Let's elaborate on that structural support. This trend line has served as reliable support since that early 2023 recovery.
Yeah, and in technical analysis, sustained support like this indicates a deeply held conviction among long-term accumulators. They are setting bids at this level and just refusing to let the price drop below it.
The most recent test of this level, followed by that strong bounce, it just reinforces the idea that buyers still view this region as a key zone for accumulation.
They're confident the risk-reward ratio favors building positions here. They're anticipating the next major upward move.
And crucially, this consistent buying pressure is ensuring that the higher low structure remains firmly intact on the weekly time frame.
A higher low structure is the textbook definition of a bullish market bias. It means that during pullbacks, the absolute lowest point the price reaches is still higher than the previous low.
It signals a shift in market psychology.
Exactly. Sellers are losing conviction on every successive dip, and buyers are stepping in sooner and at higher prices. As long as BTC holds that lower trend line, the structural bias remains undeniably bullish.
You know, sometimes observing this kind of consolidation where the market just grinds sideways, it requires incredible patience. It's hard not to feel the urge to anticipate the move.
Oh, I agree completely. That sustained patience, just waiting for the market to signal its intent rather than forcing a trade, that's one of the hardest parts of trading this kind of asset.
That patience is rewarded when the coiling structure completes. The market is consolidating into a tighter and tighter range.
It's squeezed between that ascending support and an upper resistance boundary, forming a classical wedge structure. And you often see volume drop during this compression phase.
And the sources are really unequivocal here. While the bias is bullish, the real signal for an explosive move requires a decisive breakout.
Yeah, driven by high volume above that upper wedge boundary. That breakout will confirm the compression phase is over.
And this convergence leads directly to a very specific explosive prediction noted in the source material.
Right. The next major move is likely to be explosive on January 11, 2026.
That specificity suggests a strong correlation with known upcoming non-technical catalysts.
It has to. I mean, we have to assume it aligns with key institutional deadlines, like the go-live dates for some of the regulatory pillars we're about to discuss. The thesis is that the technical coiling is nearing exhaustion, and the release will be fueled if that Fed successfully pushes capital into the primed Bitcoin structure.
The macro tailwind meets the prime technical fuse.
Ready to light up.
So how does a coiling market typically behave right before an explosive move, specifically in terms of volume?
Coiling suggests volume compression before a rapid, high-momentum breakout movement, often driven by a sudden increase in institutional buying.
Okay, moving from the technicals on Bitcoin to the foundational legal landscape that will allow institutions to finally allocate capital into this asset class, we're talking about the regulatory pillars.
And this may sound like the dry part of the conversation, but regulatory clarity is, in fact, the single most critical factor for institutional allocation. The number go up formula for broader adoption relies entirely on legal certainty.
Right. Institutions like pension funds or corporate treasuries, they just cannot risk navigating a legal gray zone.
Exactly. And the sources provide fantastic clarity here, forecasting that both major legislative pieces, the market structure bill and the SEC innovation exemption, are expected to go live in 2026.
And that defined timeline allows compliance departments globally to prepare for the inevitable shift.
Let's start with Pillar 1, which is absolutely fundamental for the institutions. The market structure bill.
This bill is designed to end the prolonged jurisdictional war between the SEC and the CFTC.
Finally, it will define clear, unambiguous rules for how crypto assets can be issued, traded, and custodied in the United States. For years, the industry has operated under the shadow of the Howey test.
A decades-old Supreme Court decision that the SEC has used to retroactively deem almost all tokens as unregistered securities.
Right, which forced major players overseas or into these prolonged legal battles. The market structure bill seeks to draw clear lines. It will define which digital assets are commodities, regulated by the CFTC, and which are securities, regulated by the SEC.
And the impact of this is truly transformative.
Oh, it is. Once this framework is codified, institutional investors, asset managers, major corporate treasuries, they all gain the legal certainty they require. They'll be able to allocate into a much broader range of crypto assets, confident they won't face certain enforcement actions.
It transitions crypto from a frontier asset to a compliant, legitimate investment category. It sets the operational standard.
Now, for Pillar 2, which is aimed squarely at innovation and the builders, the SEC innovation exemption, this is designed to solve the startup problem.
So what exactly does this exemption do?
It gives new crypto projects a critical temporary window, a set amount of time, maybe a few years, to launch and operate legally, even if they initially resemble a centralized unregistered entity.
Which is a huge deal because it addresses the chilling effect that regulation by enforcement has had on development in the U.S.
For sure. Previously, a startup team would launch, iterate, and grow, only to immediately draw the attention of the SEC, potentially crippling the project before it could achieve decentralization or, you know, product market fit.
The goal here is just pure policy pragmatism. It creates a legal sandbox environment.
Yeah. Teams can build, test utility, demonstrate their market viability, and work toward decentralization without that immediate paralyzing threat of enforcement. The exemption recognizes that innovation needs runway.
And the sources suggest this exemption will likely precede the market structure bill, maybe hitting in January 2026.
Which is fascinating timing. It means the builders get a legal green light to innovate right as the structural rules for institutions are being finalized. These two pillars, working in tandem, it's a comprehensive two-pronged approach.
The market structure bill prepares the ground for institutional capital.
And the innovation exemption provides legal cover for the builders and the technology, ensuring the pipeline of new projects doesn't dry up. It means that when the macro liquidity arrives, the regulatory foundation will be ready to absorb both the existing players and foster the next generation of dApps.
So which of these two measures is more impactful for existing institutional players versus brand new projects?
The market structure bill serves existing institutions seeking clear compliance rules, while the innovation exemption fosters new development.
Okay, our final segment. We're diving into the bleeding edge of engineering, focusing on the Solana ecosystem. They're tackling their historical limitations head-on with some critical technical updates.
This is the real nuts and bolts of high-performance blockchain architecture. So Solana Breakpoint is happening this week in Abu Dhabi, and these ecosystem conferences are vital because major technical announcements can instantly shift sentiment regardless of what the Fed is doing. The market watches for these foundational upgrades.
And the major theme for Solana has always been speed, but historically, speed has come at the cost of reliability.
Right. And they're now addressing that reliability barrier with FireDancer.
So what is FireDancer exactly?
It's a high-performance, independent validator client being developed by Jump Crypto. To understand why it's so important, you have to understand Solana's historical weakness. It traditionally relied on a single core validator client.
And the problem with a single client is redundancy and security. If there was a bug in that single code base, the whole system could crash.
Exactly. Solana suffered periods of complete network downtime because of this lack of client diversity. FireDancer solved this by creating an entirely separate, highly optimized code base for validation.
So it introduces client diversity,
which is crucial for reliability, resilience, and security. If the original client has an issue, FireDancer can continue processing blocks and maintain consensus. It essentially eliminates a single point of failure and drastically reduces Solana's historical downtime issues.
For institutional use, where reliability has to be near 100%, this is a non-negotiable step.
It is. So that's the reliability fix.
Yeah.
Now let's talk about the Pure Performance Booster, the Alpenglow upgrade, scheduled for Q1. This is where we get into the realm of truly staggering world-class performance goals.
And the sources state that Alpenglow is rumored to push Solana's maximum throughput to NASDAQ-level performance.
And the specific metric attached to this rumor is breathtaking. A potential throughput of over 500,000 maximum transactions per second. Max TPS.
Whoa. Imagine scaling a decentralized, permissionless system to handle 500,000 operations every single second. That's an order of magnitude increase over almost any other major blockchain.
It puts it squarely in competition with the highest frequency traditional financial systems globally. I mean, to contextualize 500K TPS, the NASDAQ handles peaks in the hundreds of thousands of transactions per second. Achieving that level of reliability and speed on a decentralized ledger means you can run applications that were previously impossible.
It fundamentally changes how developers must think.
It does. They no longer have to worry about the system's capacity. They can start designing applications that involve incredibly complex, high-frequency interactions like decentralized limit order books that can compete with the fastest centralized exchanges.
Or gaming worlds requiring instant settlement for millions of concurrent users.
Exactly. If they achieve reliable throughput at that level, it opens up entirely new, complex use cases for global utility.
So, will the Alpenglow upgrade fundamentally change how developers approach building on Solana?
Achieving 500K plus TPS reliability could open up entirely new, complex, and high-frequency use cases globally.
So, what does this all mean when we synthesize the macro, the technical, and the engineering segments? The big picture here is one of global monetary alignment.
Right. The environment, driven by the near certainty of a Fed rate cut and the strong rumors of balance sheet expansion, is leaning hard into a liquidity injection.
And this macro tailwind is anticipated to flow directly into risk assets, meeting a Bitcoin market that is technically primed and coiling perfectly along its long-term structural support.
That technical structure is just waiting for the final catalyst, that confirmation breakout, to release its stored energy.
And at the same time, two sets of foundational structural pillars are being diligently put in place.
On the regulatory side, the market structure bill provides compliance for institutions, and the innovation exemption protects the builders. And on the technical side, FireDancer addresses reliability, and the Alpenglow upgrade promises this unprecedented NASDAQ-level speed.
The collective message seems to be that the macro conditions are forcing capital into risk assets.
And the foundational infrastructure, both legal and technical, is being ready to absorb that massive influx of institutional and developer energy in 2026. The stage is set.
We discussed earlier how critical Thursday's U.S. 30-year bond auction is for gauging long-term institutional confidence in traditional safe assets.
Right. So here's something for you to mull over as this week closes.
Yeah.
If the Fed moves forward with both rate cuts and balance sheet expansion driving money aggressively into growth and risk assets, what's the tipping point? When do we see a systemic, noticeable collapse in demand for that long-term U.S. government debt?
It raises a really important question. Will the risk-on flood we anticipate in crypto and high-growth tech reach a velocity that genuinely destabilizes confidence in traditional sovereign debt?
When chasing yield becomes paramount, safety often takes a back seat. It's something to track closely as this monetary policy pivot continues to unfold.
Thank you for joining us for this deep dive. We hope this knowledge helps you navigate this complex and truly pivotal week ahead.